Welcome to the 22nd episode of A Change of the Champs. My name is Ryan Lowe, and my goal is to educate listeners, especially young ones, on the issues in this world by interviewing different experts who can teach us how to make a difference. In this day and age, the environment is threatened by many different forces, like plastic pollution, deforestation, factory emissions, and so much more. However, today, we'll be talking about a possible solution, something lesser known, perhaps, but is starting to come to the forefront as a realistic way to combat climate change and pollution. For the first time on A Change of the Champs, we will be talking about composting. While many don't yet take composting too seriously, it actually helps the greenhouse effect in multiple crucial ways. So today, I'm honored to introduce to you Dr. Emily Cregan. Dr. Cregan has worked a lot in organic waste to resource program development, biomass utilization research, and climate change mitigation and resilience curriculum development, which is how I got to know her. What this means is that she works a lot with compost, especially one type that we will discuss later. Furthermore, she even went to different countries to implement compost systems, helping both the environment and communities. Now, she also teaches a Johns Hopkins Center for Talented Youth course about climate change solutions, a class that I recently finished, giving me the incredible opportunity to ask her to join us today. So how are you, Dr. Cregan? It's been a little while. It's good to see you again.
Good. It's great to see you too, Ryan. And I'm just so happy that you started this podcast, and it's wonderful to be here. So thank you. I'm inspired by you too.
My pleasure. So Dr. Cregan, let's start with one of your specialties, composting. What does it really mean to compost something? What can be composted? And how effective is well-made compost as fertilizer?
Awesome. Well, composting is technically the controlled, so controlled by humans, breakdown or decomposition of organic material. So organic material, like you learned in the class, is anything that is living or once living. So that includes actually you and I are forms of organic material. Food waste is a form of organic material. I don't like to call it actually waste, but let's just say organic material. landscape material, animal manures, and of course, one of our favorites, right? Human manure. So these are, you know, carbon-based materials that naturally the planet has recycled into soil systems for as long as soil systems have been a part of our planet. And so essentially composting, again, is humans actually controlling this decomposition process. So typically we're mimicking the natural system. So we're taking larger part carbon-based material to smaller part nitrogen-based material. And then often with composting, it's an aerobic process. So as you know, that's something that involves air. Water is needed as part of the composting process. So it's a pretty simple carbon, nitrogen, water, and air. And these are things that you and I need too every day, right? So what we're doing in a compost process is catering to what? I'm going to turn it back to you for 1 second. Catering to what? Always an education moment. Microorganisms, right? So they're the ones that actually break down organic material, right? So they're actually eating and pooping out organic material, thus making the nutrients in something like a banana peel or a blade of grass more available to the plant, right? Because if we were to put a banana peel against a tree and say, hey, take up the potassium here, take up the nitrogen, take up the other elements that our bodies do, right? We ate a banana for breakfast or, you know, a cheeseburger for lunch or whatever. And so those nutrients do have to get broken down to be available to the organism. So it's a whole kind of ecosystem process. So yeah, composting though is as complex as soil systems can be and just sort of general plant systems and earth systems. Composting is actually a pretty simple process. It's just, again, catering to these microorganisms. So enough moisture, but not too much. They don't like it flooding. Plenty of oxygen. So that typically includes turning a compost pile. And then what the scientists recommend is about 30 part carbon to 1 part nitrogen. That's what's been determined as kind of the right ratio the microorganisms really like to effectively degrade organic material. So anyways, long-winded, you know me with my long-winded responses here.
But the sad thing is that not everyone notices compost as like a big solution. I feel like one way we can help that is with some statistics. So how much does food waste contribute to the greenhouse effect, and how does composting that waste help fix that problem?
Yeah, so what's really crazy, and I think something that we'll get into a little bit later in our discussion here, is this isn't something that's often taught, right, in our world today, like K through 12 education, and certainly in many majors too. So in college and university education, but we contribute, you and I, to what's called methane emissions every time we put food waste into our trash bin, and then that gets hauled to a landfill. So essentially, there's lots of different ways that our food waste or landscape material, which is kind of two more common waste streams that many of us produce, right, on a daily basis, at least food waste for sure, landscape maybe for some folks. So basically, we put that, again, I'm going to use the banana peel again, we put that into our trash bin, right? Or it could be something like a tea bag or coffee grounds or leftover rice, but we'll just say banana peel. Yeah. And then that gets picked up by a trash truck, right? A waste company. And typically that truck is using some form of fossil fuels. Often it's in the form of gasoline to transport the truck, right? And transport the food waste.
Yeah.
And so just with that step, we're producing quite a bit of carbon dioxide, which we know contributes to climate change. And then once the banana peel gets to the landfill, and again, this could be any form of organic waste material, but we're using the banana peel. Once the banana peel gets to the landfill, it actually creates methane. And getting to statistics, methane has actually been shown to be about 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, meaning it's much more effective at actually warming our planet. Ugh, so, yeah. It's crazy, right? Yeah. So I think, did I answer your full question there, or was I missing something?
Well, we can also talk a little bit about how composting that waste fixes or adds.
Yeah. Of course, the main message here. So I think a lot of folks, right, we think about, okay, if we're going to use things like animal manure or landscape waste or even food waste, those things, especially if we leave, like, again, a banana peel kind of, if we leave it to degrade, oftentimes there's a buildup of bacteria, right? So that bacteria is attracted to the organic waste material as a food source, but some of that bacteria may not be beneficial, right? So people may be concerned, well, if I'm using this organic waste material directly, right, if I put the banana peel directly onto my soil, you know, what's to stop that from adversely affecting like my tomato plant, and then I ingest some maybe form of bacteria that isn't so beneficial. So what composting does, and again, if it's done correctly, so about 30 part carbon to one part nitrogen, plenty of oxygen, and then enough moisture. And this is aerobic composting. I just want to say there are many forms of composting, but we're going to focus on kind of the what we call aerobic composting.
Yeah.
So if it's done correctly, then many of the sort of pathogens or the bacteria that's not beneficial is killed because compost systems actually get to really high heat. And I know we talked about that in class.
Yeah.
And that happens naturally, right? So it's all these bacteria that are really drawn to this kind of controlled compost system. It's like this optimal, like happy house, if you will, this huge, like, you know, wonderful, like Disneyland, if you will, for bacteria. And they're like, hey, I got everything I need here. I'm going to populate and I'm going to grow exponentially. And with that growth actually comes amazingly very high heat. So we're often seeing temperatures in aerobic compost systems that reach up to about 170 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's really, yeah, really hot.
It is.
So that tends to kill, the research has shown, you know, much of the bacteria that we wouldn't want is sort of not beneficial bacteria. So composting is a really great way to utilize, right, organic waste material. And you can compost at home. Areas all throughout California now are having to compost too, as sort of a jurisdiction or larger city or municipal scale. And so composting, again, is a great way to actually utilize organic material. and return it. I like to say the soil source. So actually return organic material to the source, to the soil. Kind of mimicking what trees and what plants have done naturally for so long, right? They drop their leaves, they drop their fruit, and that contributes again to the nutrient cycle and all sorts of beneficial things in the soil.
Yeah, it's a really amazing solution that like really bolsters the carbon cycle, right?
Absolutely, because it's like we're actually returning. Thank you, Ryan. Absolutely. We're actually returning the carbon-based material to the soil. And actually, that's what's called sort of sequestering carbon. So we're now holding the carbon within the soil system. And it is a huge way to mitigate or lessen the effects of climate change, right? Because instead of having that carbon-based material break down in a landfill where it creates methane, that carbon-based or living or once living material is now being stored in the soil system. So yeah. Absolutely.
Speaking of compost and bacteria, you also went to both Haiti and Ghana to help develop a certain type of compost system, the humanure compost. Could you explain to us what you did there and the effect that compost toilets have on the environment?
Yes, and you know it's my favorite form of composting, and yeah. I shared my love with you, and I think that my passion hopefully has rubbed off just a little bit. So in many areas of the world, like we discussed in class, toilets, whether they're compost toilets or water-based toilets, like what many of us in the US use, are not readily available, right? So you may have, when you've done maybe a little bit of international travel to what we call developing countries is one term. So for example, countries in Central America, some countries in Africa. I went to Haiti with a really great nonprofit organization called Give Love. And I actually went to be trained on how to effectively, so when I say effectively, sort of cost effectively, culturally effectively, and sort of harnessing an education-based approach, not like a dominant, we're coming here to fix, you know, some problems, but we're here to kind of teach what could be one really effective solution for people that do not have access to a toilet often in Haiti and often are getting sick. So things like cholera and dysentery that are waterborne, you know, illnesses and diseases that are often spread through human defecation, we can sort of work to mitigate that. So essentially, yeah, I went with a really great nonprofit organization. I actually approached Patricia Arquette. She's an actress and also the founder of Give Love nonprofit. And I said, I really want to join this work. I think it's really important. Again, if we can figure out how to get the human waste out of the water system and back into the soil, it can actually be a resource instead of something that degrades the people and degrades the environment. And so I went, I worked with quite a few local Haitian people, and we actually sort of learned how to develop human waste to resource compost systems at a school. And so essentially we built and we learned how to build very simple. So I think I mentioned in class that we used wooden pallets, right?
Yeah.
So something that was more readily available, really no technology system. So those are things we have to think about, right? For a place that isn't as reliant or hasn't developed their technological systems. And certainly there are all sorts of other factors like governmental corruption, high rates of poverty, all sorts of things, right? That could be a whole class in itself.
It could.
Yes. And so we worked with the local people. And then for the actual toilet part, we used, it was between, I think it was about a 10-gallon bucket. And so that we built essentially wooden porta potties. So you can imagine a porta potty. And one next to, you know, several of them next to each other. And then using a 5 or 10 gallon bucket as the main collection. So for both number one and number two. And then the most expensive part of the system was actually importing a toilet seat. You know, so essentially we would cut a hole. It was like a box, and we cut a hole and then put the toilet seat on top of that. And then the 5 or 10 gallon bin would go underneath. And so human waste is really high in nitrogen. So the main carbon source we use, and we taught the people, hey, every time you go to the bathroom, just grab a handful of sugarcane bagasse, which is sort of like the leaves and stuff, which is higher carbon content of sugarcane production, which is one of the main or even one of the few things that at the time, this was about, let's see, about 6 years ago now, that people in Haiti were growing locally. So again, using locally available sort of resources. And then we would train the people. So once the 5 or 10 gallon bin kind of filled up again with carbon-based sugarcane bagasse and then human waste, higher nitrogen waste, they would dump that into a larger sort of compost bin that we built with wooden pallets. And then following Joseph Jenkins, he's written a lot on human manure. There's a couple books that I think I've shared with you that he's written that tends to be more reputable and science-based. That material actually sits unturned for about a year.
Yeah.
And so we did provide 2 thermometers and we'd see the temperatures get really, really high, but it wasn't a smelly system. It was a working system. So there weren't a lot of bad odors. And again, we are keeping this, what I consider precious, you know, it's human poop essentially. And I see that as a precious resource. We were keeping that out of the water stream and then eventually back into them producing their own plants, their own things that they would eat and then also sell at market. So it's a really great kind of full circle initiative. So I hope to do more of this in the future.
Yeah, compost toilets really are pretty amazing, from what you just mentioned, the smell to how they affect everyone. It's really a win-win-win-win situation.
And thank you. I totally agree.
Yeah. Also, your love for them has indeed rubbed off on me. If you can recall, I did my final project on compost toilets, right?
I very much recall. You chose a really important region in India and the Ganges River, and one that's highly polluted. And so what did you think about your process? Was that pretty cool to kind of get to know, like, hey, composting toilets could be an actual option here?
Yeah. Well, a lot of that is sort of the reason why I really thought this episode would be super important.
Nice. Thank you. I'm so glad you learned so much.
So more on composting toilets. While we know they can protect the environment, how can building compost toilets in poorer countries really help the people who use them? You talked a little bit more about that, but could you please elaborate?
Yeah, no problem. So I think, you know, from my perspective, and you know that I did my master's degree in kind of agricultural sciences and soil sciences. So kind of a combination of soil and ag sciences. So from my perspective, you know, agriculture and food production is kind of the foundation of society, right? If we start looking at history and kind of how people develop things like agriculture and things that we grow are used to make clothing. You know, they're used to build our buildings. Of course, we grow things to eat. And so if we can help empower people to use their locally available resources to their benefit, right, instead of having it be something that harms them or is causing them illness or to die, for example. And if, like you said, a win-win-win-win, if we could reverse it and take something that, again, is currently causing a lot of harm for folks where they're having to go to the bathroom near their drinking sources, and instead we're working to create sort of, you know, a drinking source that people can actually drink in time, a water source that people can actually utilize in time, because we're working to get the pollution out of the water stream and then back into the soil. And the soil does, and really composting does, and it's all goes back to the microorganisms, an amazing job at degrading organic material, whereas the water doesn't, right? So the soil and really composting is used to sort of harness the nutrient source and organic waste material. And then the big thing too, Ryan, in many regions, And, you know, we're experiencing it. I mean, in the Bay Area, you just hit 105, 110 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. And so we have to look at not only the nutrient potential of organic material in our soil, but also how it can play a big role in sort of climate change resilience, yeah. Right? So if we can actually get the organic material back into the soil, that plays a big role in the soil's ability to conserve water. So it's like we're taking something that may be higher in sand, like a soil that could be higher in sand content. We know if we go to the beach and we take a handful of sand and we pour water through it, water goes right through it, right? But if we add a little bit of compost or a handful of soil that's kind of higher in organic material plus sand, the water goes through much slower. So increasing the soil's carbon content or organic matter content does increase the soil's ability to retain water. So it's that much more helpful for plants, right? Because plants need water to grow, and that in turn helps the people. So,
yeah,
you know, Haiti is an island nation, for example, and Ghana too is a coastal nation on the west side of Africa, sort of central west, north central west. So really looking at ways to use our resources to, you know, essentially become more resilient to the effects of climate change, where many regions and many poorer people in regions are going to be that much more affected by our warming temperatures, right? So yeah, that has a good effect, of course. And then, like we talked about a bit, is, you know, essentially is I see composting as a mechanism to repair and rejuvenate whole ecosystems, because in many developing countries, often the people will take the larger trees to build buildings and to build houses. And then that really, that what tends to be that nutrient rich topsoil, you know, the maybe 2 or 3 inches of topsoil are now not being held down by the tree roots. And so often in many areas, they lose that nutrient rich where the leaves would drop from the trees. And so there'd be that high content of carbon within the top layer of the soil. Oftentimes in many, especially regions that are already suffering economically, that resource isn't renewed, right? So trees aren't planted again, right? And so if we can use compost to actually rejuvenate and repair whole ecosystems, then that's working to rejuvenate and repair the people and the economy. So it's a whole sort of positive, what do you call it? Sort of positive upcycle, right? So yeah.
Hearing about like all these different ways compost is a solution, I don't see how anyone could possibly not fall in love with it, Ms. Treacon.
I did a good job teaching you, Ryan. That yes, really warms my heart. My job was done then. Thank you, Ryan. Remember, I think I told you that the first day. My job is to help you fall in love with your ability to create change. And really, yeah, if you also fell in love with composting, that warms my heart even more.
So as I discussed earlier, you've also created an entire class and curriculum around climate change called Everything is Connected, Solutions to a Warming World. Taking this class taught me so much about climate change and has given me a new analytical perspective on climate change solutions. So I was wondering, what motivated you to start that class?
Oh, right. And that's just so great to hear, you know, because of course I was once a freshman in high school. I was once in eighth grade. And as you know, I mentioned, I'm in my 30s. I mentioned that at some point. So I'm not too old. I'm from the Bay Area, which tends to be, you know, a bit more progressive, I would say, in terms of education. And of course, yeah, other things. There may be other parts of the world. We had to generalize. Of course, you and I are both biased because we're from the Bay Area, but
yeah.
But you know, I realized growing up, Ryan, that, and I know I've expressed this in class too, that I don't feel I was given the tools or really empowered to create change. And that's just really, really important, right? Because we're in a time in history when I think it's so much better than just to be given information, right? Just to be told like, hey, this is happening. Like climate change is happening. Here are the problems. I think that's important. But I think it's even better to kind of say, hey, here are some of the problems, and then have the next generations and really empower the next generations to create the solutions. And really with my work in Haiti, with Give Love Nonprofit and the other work I've done, empowering people, I think, is so much more effective at creating change than really any other modality or any other sort of tactic, right? Because I can walk in and say, hey, I have a PhD in this stuff. Like, listen to me, you know, it's like, well, no, how about you do the research, you figure out what the problem is, and then use your analytical skills, like you said, use the tools, some of the tools I provided in class, you know, like how to develop an economic analysis, how to develop a cultural analysis, how to figure out what is climate change mitigation versus climate change resilience, and why are both important? You know, what do these definitions mean? Where does carbon come from? What is the carbon cycle? So kind of giving you this larger toolkit and then allowing you to create and allowing you to initiate the actual change, right?
Yeah.
And the reason too, I mentioned economic and cultural analysis is because I developed this course to be based on real world analysis of a climate change related problem, right? And that could be all sorts of things, water related, agricultural related, landscape related, of course, transportation, electricity related.
Yeah.
And of course, I think you learned too in the class that what you developed in one part of the world, which your group chose India, can certainly translate to many other regions, right, around the world.
Absolutely.
It's not just sort of like, hey, it's just the Ganges River and the people here in India that are suffering with this problem. No, this is a global, climate change is happening globally, and there's a lot happening. So yeah, I proposed this course a while ago. I told Johns Hopkins University I would love to develop this. Here's the reasons why. And it is, as I've mentioned in class, it is a bit upsetting to me that the brunt of climate change is really going to fall on, let's say, my generation, the generation before me, and then your generation, to really try to solve. And if you're not empowered with the ability to solve, then where are we headed, right? And so, that's why I initiated this course. It was, as I've told you too, on a personal note, it was a little bit scary to do so, because I'm like, why is nobody else doing this? And let's actually do this. And so I really hope that in the future, I can continue along this path and maybe help influence larger education models, right? So I think you learned a lot, and I always get the feedback that this was new information too for like high school students, right, in our class. And it's sad to me to get to junior or senior level and not have this basic information. So that's why I initiated it, and I hope to continue. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I just want you to know that all of the amazing things that you've taught me and countless others have not gone in vain.
Oh, thank you, Ryan. And that's the basis of it, right? Like, it's not even about me, it's about you. And I think you realize in the process, wow, with a group of people, with working with other people, harnessing our own intellect and our skills and our research skills and our presentation skills, like you're a great presenter, for example. I think you kind of rubbed off on your group members too in that way. Hey, we could do this or do that. And working together, you produce something really amazing, you know, and a very viable option for the region that you chose.
Thanks. So how have you and your class inspired students to make a change in the world, example-wise? In your opinion, is education the most important way to fix the future? And you talked about that too, but could you elaborate as well?
Yeah, thank you. And I'm kind of, like I said, you hit my passion point here. So I'm kind of bleeding into one question and the next. And so yeah, real world example. So one of, and I think I mentioned this to you all too in class, and this, of course, you're not obligated to do this as part of the course, but a couple of the groups in past, Everything is Connected, Solutions for a Warming World courses, the students would actually reach out to the region that they studied and the region where they developed a a real world climate change solution. And so a couple of groups actually reached out to local governments and said, here's the research that we did. We're part of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Talented Youth, and we worked on this for such amount of time, and here's the research that we found, and here's the potential solution that we've determined. And again, the solution includes the economic analysis, right? At least partial, some economic analysis. Of course, this isn't a PhD dissertation, you know, but you put some effort and time and research into how much this could potentially cost. If this is something that could work for the society, again, we've talked about how would certain solutions fit into particular societies, looking at religious components. In a place like India, for example, many people don't eat beef, right? So it could be, you know, a good option here for parts of India to go in certain directions, but maybe not parts of Texas, for example, where beef has become an integral part of their economy. But still, there's always room for change. And so a couple of student groups have reached out to government. I haven't heard quite if anything came of it, but I think education and providing each other with the information and the education is a huge part of trying to fix this climate change problem. I don't think it's the only part. I think we really have to think in a way that's multi-pronged. For example, I'm really hoping that at least a few of you eventually become CEOs or directors of large companies. And you can say, hey, in part because of this class that I took with Dr. Cregan many years ago and everything that I learned and all the initiatives I took thereafter, I want to create a better company model here. You know, I want to create one that has a lower carbon footprint, one that thinks about transportation, one that influences local transportation. So maybe mandating partial hybrid type work, right? So people are transporting less, or advocating for public transportation, using alternative forms of energy, using large scale solar or wind power, you know, buying locally, buying food locally and supporting local farms. So then produce and food for the company kitchen isn't being flown in or shipped in from thousands of miles away. So there's, So I think education is one big, because again, I see education as a modality or as a huge avenue to empower the next generations with their own ability to create change, not just today, but for the future. But certainly not the only one. Yeah. So, I can share one other quickly. So, I did teach in person at one point. It wasn't at Johns Hopkins, at a different school, but I did, of course, have to teach. I had to integrate climate change education and sort of this problem solution model. And the students actually developed and they conducted their first ever campus waste audit.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And so essentially this campus, this school, the private school here in San Diego, California, is almost 100 years established. So this is like a 100-year-old school. They've never conducted a waste audit, right? And of course, we know organic waste plays a huge role in climate change, right? And so the students actually conducted it. They separated the waste, they weighed it, they determined percentages. And then they, Ryan, actually presented solutions to the administration. And guess what? The administration implemented at least a couple of these solutions. How cool. Like, they actually influenced change, right? And that was...
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes. So I just think, and again, these were seventh graders. So I just think the ability even for the young folks to learn while implementing change, there's so much capacity for that. There needs to be more of it, you know?
Yeah. It just goes to show how good you are at inspiring people.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I'm always learning myself, and certainly this life is full of opportunity to grow and learn, but I appreciate you saying that. It really warms my heart, and I'm doing my best. You know, that's all we can really do.
Of course. So one of my favorite parts of your class was learning about the differences between climate change mitigation and climate change resilience. However, many people have not yet learned about these terms. So what do climate mitigation and resilience mean? What are some current examples, and which would you say is more crucial in the current state of the world?
I just have to say, Ryan, these are great questions too. So thank you. Yeah, and I agree with you because I think I've shared in class, you know, I would talk to my family, for example, during Thanksgiving dinner or whatever. I'm always trying to fit this information in. And even my educated, you know, at least a few people in my family have PhDs, many have master's degrees. Of course, not climate change focused or not environmental science focused, but they didn't know these definitions, right? They had heard of them. It's like, oh, these kind of like buzzwords. So I totally agree with you that a lot of folks are like, hey, I've kind of heard of this, but what does it mean? And so climate change mitigation means to mitigate the actual direct effects of climate change. So that means, yeah, and I see you smiling because you're like, I know, I drilled it into you guys. I know because really, once you know some of the kind of crucial definitions, you can actually start to like formulate thoughts about them and then create change, right? So, so basically, to mitigate climate change is to either reduce the kind of prominent climate change gases. So that would be something like, you know, carbon dioxide, of course, or methane, nitrous oxide. So reducing the prominent climate change gases. So that could be something like driving less, right? So many of us drive, whether it's our parents driving or us driving. And unless we have an electric vehicle or some sort of hybrid vehicle, we're using quite a bit of gasoline, which is a fossil fuel. And once that gasoline is sort of burned or ignited for energy in our vehicles, the byproduct of that is carbon.
Yeah.
Carbon then combines with oxygen, creating CO2. And so something like driving less would be an example. Also something like doing a waste audit at your school, even your high school now, right? I'm giving you a little ideas here, which I know you've probably already thought about. I know you're just starting here in ninth grade, but anyhow, it's an idea for the future. And then encouraging your school to maybe go partial solar, right? To maybe install some solar panels, right? And to say, hey, school, you could actually save this much money in the long term too, if you consider this, right? Which can often be kind of a push for people. But yeah, so those are examples of climate change mitigation. And then climate change resilience is actually being resilient against the current effects of climate change today. So for example, we've been experiencing in California a lot of wildfires, right?
Yeah.
And so we can't directly affect what's happening today, right? So if there's going to be a wildfire next door, or my mom lives in Sonoma, California. So last week it got up to about 115 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh,
and that was middle of September. Or I'm sorry, less than middle, beginning of September, September 5th or 6th, it was like 115 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's crazy.
I know. And it's like, these are the effects of climate change that people have to be resilient to today, right? I mean, some folks we know can die of heat stroke, especially more vulnerable folks, like older folks or younger folks. And so in many other areas, let's say related to rising global temperatures, people don't have access to potable or drinkable water, right? So that's another example of how people are having to be resilient against the current effects of climate change. And so you asked me too, Ryan, you know, do I think one or the other is better? Well, I think it's kind of like a yin yang. Like we need to still focus on mitigation. There's a lot of hope. As a scientist, I've read a lot of the studies, and I'm sure you've heard of them. This isn't part of your question, but just a quick aside here. You know, a lot of studies that say we are going to be doomed here, but I think we haven't done enough application of, for example, the other part of climate change mitigation, which is sequestering carbon. How do we get carbon back into our living systems? So, you know, trees do this naturally.
Yeah.
They photosynthesize and they take up CO2 and use it to build their living parts. They use the carbon to build their living parts. And so, you know, the research really predicts the outcome if we continue to emit carbon-based gases the way that we are today. But there isn't enough research on, hey, if Ryan decides like, hey, he's going to approach a school and he's going to get an on-site compost program going with the club he's going to be a president for in 2 years, or 1 year, or this year, potentially. And so your school can actually mitigate that much more carbon by composting, right? So what happens if they're like, hey, Ryan Lowe's idea is great here with this one school, we're going to make this happen with the whole school district. And then suddenly we start actually making changes. And I think what the models predict can start shifting. So I think there's a lot of hope here, but both the mitigation and resilience, I would say, play roles. And they're both important. Because of course, we're having to deal with drought. You know, you and I are from California. We're having to deal with drought. And we hear about it all the time. Well, climate change is playing a very big role in that. So, and again, we know with composting, that's a big way to be resilient, right? We can increase the water holding capacity of the soil just by composting. So, yeah.
Well, I feel like there's still a lot of hope left in the future, but big changes can only be made when you have amazing teachers like you.
Oh, well, and amazing students like you. I'm just so amazed. Thank you. This Thank podcast you started, I can't remember when, but a while ago.
Yeah, it was 2019, December.
Yeah, so you're actually working to create change, which is really all we can do. And you're working to educate people, which I really honor you for that, too.
Thank you so much.
I'm proud of you.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for talking to me today. I have learned so much more about composting and educating youth. Never stop inspiring today's youth and shaping the future's fighters, Ms. Tregan.
Thank you so much, Ryan. That just warms my spirit and my heart. And I wish you the best of luck. I'm always here. So anytime you want to reach out, if you want any input, you know my contact info.
Of course. Yeah. So that's it for Change the Chance, episode 22. I hope you've learned something, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.
Thank you so much, Ryan.